Two.
Chris, the question we'll be discussing today is, do you encourage your players to roleplay their PC's religious beliefs and affiliation in your games?
Interesting. Hello and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rowe.
Andy, it's a really good question we rolled on that table. I'm interested in diving into that. So you put this table together recently for us to kind of just get us sort of back on track with rolling.
I did, rolling. Yes.
Yeah. So it's very fun. I will let you know that I've intentionally sort of not been reading what the table is.
Okay.
So I can be as surprised.
Even better. Yeah. So I'm excited to talk about this first because it's there's no way this could drift into like hot button real world topics at all. Yeah. And secondly, I don't think we have talked about this. Like an awful lot of our topics, 5 or 6 years in, there's just an inevitable bit of not repetition exactly, but overlap in some of the topics we discuss. And this was one I don't think we've ever talked about. So having said that, someone will write in and say like, well, this is the exact question you did on episode number 43. Yes. But
yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I mean, that would be amazing. I mean, can you imagine if we found out that there was like a Roll for Topic wiki that someone would keep up to date? I think I'd be embarrassed for everybody, but maybe someday.
Mostly for myself as like all of my, I'm trying to imagine somebody documenting all of my whining and travails about like setting up games and making overly ambitious GMing goals. I just assume no one's documenting this and it will never come back to haunt.
It's a each episode is going to have a very long contradictions and controversies. Okay, all right, before we get into the topic though, there's a couple things that I wanted to touch base on more specifically. So you had mentioned this past week that you've been watching the Dune TV show.
Prophecy, yes, because they're like, what is a really dumb word that's used in like every dumb movie you've ever heard, like let's see, Apocalypse is Taken, it's a prophecy. That's one.
It fits.
This is like an actual setting where there are like actual prophets delivering prophecies. So
yes. So you had mentioned it sort of in context of like, so we've talked before about like, how would you ever run a game in the universe of Dune and make it interesting if you're not following like Paul Atreides, right? So it sounded like you might have had a couple ideas along those lines, or like, you know, something from that show is sticking out to you.
Well, it's not so. thanks a lot for putting me on the spot here.
Yeah, because I have more of a statement than a question.
Right. Yes. Okay. It's not so much that I have ideas. It's so listeners, you may stop listening right now.
Yeah.
No value will come out of this.
Yeah.
No, but as I was watching it, I mean, I thought of our conversations because I use Dune as my standard example of a setting where like, it's how could you really role play in this? The entire setting of Dune is just, I mean, it's all bound up in the story of Paul Atreides and his ancestors, if you read the sequels. And it just seems to me like the quintessential example of a story that has already been told. So there's not really any space for your PCs to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But this show then comes along and there are some Atreides in it, but they, unlike a lot of like the written, like the Dune prequels and sequels written by his son, which, I don't really recommend, although I've read a number of them. those are all good examples of just like retreading the plot of the main book. Mm-hmm. And so I went into this Dune prophecy thinking, well, here we go. It's set 10,000 years before the novel Dune, yet somehow it's going to end up being about a person who becomes a messianic figure on Arrakis among the Fremen, right?
Yeah.
But no, so it just, it doesn't, there's maybe a total of 90 seconds of footage of Arrakis in across the 7 or so hours of runtime. The Atreides aren't the main characters. There's a couple of Atreides in the show. And, I mean, so what it did is it just kind of boldly, I think it was like, this can't be a story about spice or Arrakis or the Atreides or the Quetzalcoatl, right? Mm-hmm. And they've found something interesting in the backstabby politics of the Imperium,
yeah.
Which are, they're in the Dune series. They're a little bit backgrounded, but they're certainly there. And I guess I just hadn't thought how rich of a vein in the Dune universe that is. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I mean, the whole setup of Dune is that as before the book started, a lot of backstabby politics happened for the purpose of like maneuvering the Atreides into a big political trap.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
For the most part, that's already done when the book starts. You see, mm-hmm. You certainly see the aftermath of all of that backstabbiness. So I think, you know, I don't have any ideas except to say I was wrong on this one. And I was surprised at how much of Dune you could simply ignore and have it feel like Dune.
Interesting.
And I realize that's not really helpful because I'm just saying they did it well. And I don't know if I could articulate exactly why it worked. Like, I don't know. Do you have any reactions to that?
Yeah. Is it sort of the feeling of it feels like Dune, or I guess more specifically, it was sort of like the new Dune movies, or is it more than that?
I mean, it looks like Dune, which is a big part of it. It shares the general aesthetic of the new Dune movies, which I think have a pretty striking look and feel. And it just captures the tone where everyone is really serious.
Yes.
Everyone is thinking something differently than what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more like they identified the themes in their themes and like extrapolated on them. But because those themes really are in the original work, it feels like a natural iteration of the setting.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you mentioned sort of the hinting at all like the political backstabbing and maneuvering and stuff that happened sort of before Dune. And I can't say necessarily that like I wanted a whole book of that, but the points at which the book in particular sort of slowed down and like dove into, like, yeah, you know, I think there's like a table, like there's a dining room scene, I feel like, in that book, if I remember correctly, where you are getting that sort of like, he says this, but he actually means this. And like,
yes.
You know, you're getting sort of like everybody's sort of internal dialogue there. So it's like, yeah, cool, like cool action fantasy movie. But there's also sort of like this very grounded, like, you can sort of understand how these people might be fighting and backstabbing with each other, right, over these like large resources that they want to have access to. So I mean, you know, and clearly a lot of those squabbles have been going on for millennia, right? So like, it makes a lot of sense to just like, let's go back 10,000 years and sort of see where maybe some of this came from.
So I wish I had more concrete advice. I wish I had taken some like exact lessons out of it. But it has got me eyeing some, you know, other things like Middle Earth and other settings that just seem so wrapped up in the story that's already been told, that it's sometimes hard to imagine the PCs being something other than just like creeping along in the margins of the main story, which can be fun, but you know, it is pretty limiting. We've gone through, you know, many iterations of the Middle Earth RPG, and I think we've got a really good one right now that's in print. But you know, it still has that lingering sense of like, if your PCs really rock, maybe they'll have like an unacknowledged background supporting role, you know, to
yes.
Maybe they can pave the way for the, you know, for Bilbo. Maybe they fend off a threat that would have challenged Bilbo and the dwarves and they never knew it, right? I mean, I'm not saying that's a bad story you could tell, but it's less exciting than being Bilbo and the dwarves, right?
Yeah, totally. There's a Lord of the Rings video game that I played like an hour of, I think, for the PlayStation 2, where you're very much like some side characters to like the main story that you're kind of running around and like maybe fixing up a couple things, or like, you know, handling something that the movie's sort of like backgrounded a little bit. And it's like, it's a little fun, but then, I mean, the cutscenes happen and you just sort of want to see Aragorn do something cool. Like,
right.
Like that's what you're really, really sort of after. It's not necessarily the, like, I'm also existing in Middle Earth and I've got my own thing going on. It's like, well, there's this huge conflict that is, you know, the story of like, how do you turn away from that and do something else?
Yeah. Something like Dune setting has the advantage, now that I think of it, of it. It is such a huge span of time that it covers. And it's implied that the setting has been pretty like static as far as technology and the structure of the government of the setting and things like that. I mean, in Doom Prophecy, it takes place 10,000 years before Dune the movie, but all the tech is there that you recognize, right?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And the Dune books, I realize that these got fleshed out in a big way by the millions of prequels and stuff written by Frank Herbert's son. But the Dune books themselves are full of those things, like in Star Wars, where like, oh yeah, we fought in the Clone Wars, and then they don't explain the Clone Wars. And there, that does create a lot of space for you to be like, what, I wonder what the Clone Wars were. And, you know, famously George Lucas came along and gave us the Clone Wars. And, you know, I think everyone would agree they are less cool than whatever you thought when you first watched Star Wars and heard the mention of the Clone Wars, and your brain went wild wondering what that might have looked like. And I don't say that to be snarky. I'm like, I mean, I'm being kind of serious. Like, I think that's a, there's an art to throwing out little teasers and letting the viewer, the reader, just fill in the spaces there. In this case, Dune has a lot of teasers and a lot of like blank space on the map. So
yeah, there's, I know we've talked about this before. Like, that is something that in sci-fi and fantasy, I mean, I just so appreciate the, like, that detail that is never explained, that is just sort of there. Like, you don't need the plot totally figured out around it, or like to have a really good explanation for it. Cause it's all invented sort of anyway. It's like, sort of the more you explain it, the less magic there is to it.
Speaking of magic, you know what does this really well, or at least it did it really well, was Magic the Gathering. Like, when I played Magic the Gathering in the first couple years that it came out, almost more than the game itself, I loved those little quotes and stuff on the cards reference elements of the setting or events or characters with absolutely no explanation or context for them. And I realize over the last, 35 years or something, that stuff, there's probably novels, there's probably wikis that have filled in all of those spaces. But for a while, that was the most mysterious, exciting fantasy space to live in that I had encountered in a long time.
Yeah, I remember there's a bunch of cards that mentioned Urza back in the day.
Okay.
Like, and yeah, there's just like all these like little cards, like a lot of artifacts and things like that. I'm just like, who is this person, right? And this was again before you could just go to the fan wiki and be like, okay, Urza is this, born in this year, whatever, right? Like, and I'm sure there's, again, like you mentioned, there's probably novels, probably someone has made a movie of it or whatever. But like, yeah, but like those things just really captured my imagination. And I remember I was never a good Magic the Gathering player because I would always get stuck on like putting a theme together for a deck. Right. So I'd often, you know, be like, oh, like I want it, like these cards sort of fit together. Like, I really want to make this work because like, I want to use all of Urza's artifacts. Right.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. That sort of stuff. Yeah. And of course it would never work at the table, but it's like, yeah, to me, it was like those tantalizing bits of flavor text were just like, that's what gets your mind going. That's like what you want to do. And I don't know, like to tie it back to this podcast, like it is what drives me to play these games is like seeding those details and then trying to either make them work or just having them to be this like background, like flavor to the world. Background flavor to the world that you're inhabiting when you're playing the game.
Absolutely. I have one other, a little media thing, and I just want to mention it. We don't have to have a big discussion, but so I've been watching the Hobbit movies with my 13-year-old son. So we watched the Lord of the Rings movies as a family. It's the first time my kids had really seen them all the way through over the holidays. And my son wanted more. So I was like, well, those Hobbit movies. So despite, I mean, don't worry, I have all the party approved opinions about the Hobbit films, but I also own, you know, the extended Blu-ray editions of all of them for some reason. Like, I couldn't tell you how they came into possession, but they're there on the shelf. And I just wanted to say that the Venn diagram of things every single critic singled out as the worst and things that delighted my son so much that he like burst out laughing and has been talking about them for weeks, that the Venn diagram overlap is 100% between those things. It's a watching movies with kids, man, it's a revelation.
I mean, it's the same thing, like, you know, Jar Jar Binks, widely derided, and you show that movie to any child, and they're just like, this is the best thing ever, right? You know, like, you did the exact same thing with the Ewoks back in the day, right? It's like,
absolutely.
My daughter and I are still reading that. I know we've talked about this. This is sort of our Hobbit corner, I guess, at this point. But, yeah, she's starting to get into it a little bit more, which is great. So they've just escaped the spiders, and they just realize that Thorin's been captured and is no longer with them. And I was so proud of her. She clocked that they did not have Thorin, right? So they like, oh, some spiders, they're in Mirkwood, the spiders sort of capture everybody, and Bilbo very heroically, like, kind of rescues all the dwarves, and they, like, yeah, and my daughter's like sort of counting, she's like, well, they're missing someone. I'm like, no, they're not, they got everybody, because I'd forgot about this part of the book, and it's like, yeah, like, no, they totally have everybody. And then, like, you know, we keep reading, and then I think Bomber, doesn't matter, one of the dwarves is like, where's Thorin? Yeah. you know, where's Thorin? And I'm just like, oh my goodness, like, you called it. She was like so excited and so happy for herself. Yeah, it's great.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So all that aside, so there's one other thing that I wanted to talk about, and then we should really get into our topic at hand. So I finally got together with one of my friends in the neighborhood. We've been talking about doing this for a while, of starting sort of a neighborhood game, just to play some, you know, tabletop games together. He plays a lot. He was at the last con. So we finally got, like, a time. We got, you know, got together. We played just a one-page RPG. So longtime listeners of the podcast might remember Andy and I played this game called Sports Are Just Numerology. This was like 4 years ago or so, maybe even longer than that. But it was really fun when we played it back then. So I played it with my friend this past week, and it's still great. It's a really fun game where you invent two sports players sort of at the end of their careers, looking back on their careers, and you take turns rolling dice, rolling D10s to generate a random number, and then you have to take that number and turn it into a stat that's like part of your career, right? You know, so like we just went back and forth and did that. But I mean, talk about like inventing background and backstory, right? So like what I told you, like that's all the rules, right, to it. But by the time that we were done playing that game, we had invented a fake NFL team. We had this whole backstory. There was three or four other like NPCs that we were referencing throughout, and all that. And then it just being this like this very delightful little one shot that we got to play together. So that was super fun. And this is me sort of recommending that game again, if you ever find yourself in a position, yeah, where you want to play something with one other person.
I have very fuzzy memories of playing that game, but it's all positive memories. And yeah, I would honestly play that game again anytime. Yeah. We should consider doing a little episode where we touch on that game again. That was
Yeah. I'd like that. It was, so we decided to, right, because the Super Bowl just happened over here in the United States. Yeah, so we decided to do like a, you know, football related thing. And it was very funny watching us both sort of struggle to like recall how football is actually played.
Yes.
You get a couple nerds together who aren't quite sure.
Yeah.
But
that reminds me, this week I had a sports friend of mine explain to me Michigan football. Like, so I know all the basics now. I know there's two teams in Michigan.
Yes, there are.
that's about all I know. But like, I've lived a very long time not, I mean, you see mention of the Spartans and the Wolverines.
Yeah.
And like, I don't really know, like, those are teams, obviously. Are they like rivals? Are they the same team? Are they friends? Like, I'm all caught up now. And if we play Sports or Numerology, I will be going into it with a deep knowledge of Michigan football, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I still remember, like, so you didn't grow up in Michigan either. So like, I didn't grow up in Michigan. And when I moved here, like, one of the very first things I got asked by like the first stranger I met was like, well, are you a State fan or a Michigan fan? And I was like, yes. Are those different? Like, yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's like, I feel like I'm in a very different place. Yeah.
Yes. Well, for me moving to the Midwest, I had that experience I grew up kind of following like NFL football.
Oh, okay.
But the idea of college sports always felt a little ghoulish, and it still does. Like, it's weird to me that we have national conversations and criticisms of like how 20-year-olds are performing. Yeah. I just want them to like do okay in their classes, right?
Oh, that's such a dad opinion. Yeah.
Yeah. But obviously when you move to the Midwest, people seem much more fired up about college football than like a pro football or whatever.
I will, the thing that finally made me interested in college sports, I think I was talking to one of my sports friends, and they just mentioned that like, it's, since it's not quite professional level, like it can get a little nuttier. Like the games are a little bit less controlled.
That makes sense.
In some ways, which makes it a lot more fun, right? Because so you don't have a team of highly polished people that have like literally any resource imaginable to them to train and to get better and all that, that sort of stuff. So the games in college, like are just like, they're more exciting, like, especially like basketball, like people get into super into March Madness. And again, like I'm not a big sports fanatic. Like I'll watch stuff every once in a while, but like March Madness is super fun because again, you don't have these super professional players. Like they still kind of make mistakes. Someone gets hurt. You have to get a second string person out there who like maybe doesn't play that often, right?
And yeah, they're not always doing the optimal move, maybe. That, when you put it like that, that actually makes it sound kind of intriguing.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of intriguing. Like, so that part's fun, but the, you know, putting all your hopes and dreams on a, you know, 18-year-old who has been exploited by a system that isn't so great, that's not, maybe not the best.
Well, thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, okay.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
We should move into our topic, but we keep adding things to talk to before we get to our topic. We're avoiding the hot button topic of religion, but I want to call out in a positive way the Splatbook podcast. We talk about it a lot, obviously, but they in a recent episode, they actually devoted an entire episode to responding to our episode. And talking about the question of basically what's the deal with like these, you know, white whale campaigns, and why do we want to do them? How do you make them successful? What are we all reaching for when we talk about these or think about them? And that was John, Ben, Jess, and then they had, I think, Matt on as a guest. Yeah. It was a great conversation. It was awkward hearing my name mentioned so much, I made it through the episode. Yeah. And I encourage you to give that a listen, especially if you've been listening to us talk about these and are like, are Andy and Chris ever going to really like get over themselves and figure out their like their gaming goals? So
yeah,
if you want practical advice, there was a lot of it in that episode for like how to think about those big complex campaigns and like ask yourself the really good questions, like why are you doing this, what's appealing, and then what are some practical steps you can take to achieve that, like whatever that experience is that you're after. So go give them a listen.
We often sort of talk about our goal with role for topic. We know when we've been successful, when there's like a conversation that gets generated by it. So it's very flattering to get that kind of a full rebuttal, podcast recorded for us. But I super appreciated listening to it just because they had such a different perspective on like the idea of a white whale game than I did. So I'm not going to spoil it. Go listen to it. I think it is well worth listening to, even if you did not hear us kind of blather on about what a white whale game might be. I think they do a really good job sort of recapping what Andy and I said in that episode. But yeah,
agreed. Yeah, there's I feel like we're a success if we two dummies like accidentally introduce a topic that actual smart people then like pick up and discuss. So hey, with that said, shall we jump into our topic, or did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, that's it. Yeah, let's talk about this a little bit.
Let me frame it a little bit. Obviously, with the breadth of role-playing games out there playing, I think what this question is getting at, or let's just decide, please disagree if you want, Chris. I think when I put this on there, I had in mind fantasy settings with like D&D style religious systems in place. Obviously every setting has its own spin on religion and what religions are in there, and for practical purposes, what do you think about talking about this mostly within the framework of that, like there's this polytheistic setting where the gods like tangibly exist?
I think that's good. I don't know if we can, we only have like maybe 15 minutes. I don't know if we can really fully address like a metaphysical idea of like whether or not God exists. So I think yes, this is a good sort of starting point.
Just lob this out the gate. Think about your last D&D or D&D-ish game, Chris. Did religion play a role that impacted the game in any way?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I think this is kind of a fascinating part about these, these kind of fantasy games, right? You have sort of the pantheon of gods, and, people pick, whatever whatever god or gods that they're following. And I like the idea that it's just sort of a given that they do exist and that they are going to interact with the world, because I think it allows for like an understanding of sort of the power level of your setting as well too. It's like you have your heroes, but then there's also this, sort of these demigods and gods that could, you know, smite you with one one flick of their finger if they wanted to. Right. So I think like that's pretty interesting. So I do sort of lean into that when running games like that. I think it can be a little bit hard to remember, because sometimes like your heroes just want to go swing their sword, right? So if you're like interrupting them every once in a while, be like, hey, you know, like you got this, you know, god that you need to go pray to or whatever, you know, yep. here and there. That can get a little bit annoying. But whenever a player sort of like wants to lean into that, I'm more than happy to like let them lean into that, because I think it can create some interesting incentives for them as well, because oftentimes, like especially with I think warlocks, this happens a lot in D&D, where their deity is asking them to do stuff that is not necessarily going to be in the best interest of the party. That makes sense. Yeah, so like that can create some interesting friction, interesting and good friction there. But yeah, what about you?
I really like what warlocks have added to D&D. I know the concept of them has been around forever, but I think their current incarnation, where they have a patron, like a unique patron, that has a personality and goals, it's really just like a reflavored cleric, relationship with their deity. But I feel like it, I don't know, it kind of reminded me that the relationship between a player and the power that they serve can be idiosyncratic and interesting and maybe a little confounding for the player.
Yeah.
And I find that pretty. So I like taking what the warlock has reminded us of and porting it over to, you know, your kind of traditional, like, oh, I follow the lawful good god of sunshine stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, do you find, so one thing that I find difficult is like once you get outside of the cleric and the warlock, kind of having interesting interactions with deities, with like your other player, like other character classes. Yeah, I guess have you looked at that more specifically and tried to figure out an interesting way to do that?
No, and I'm glad you brought this up, because this is on my mind too. I tried to make the deities like important to the characters whose character class is like intrinsically tied to a deity, whether that's a cleric or, you know, some of the other spellcasting classes. But I basically have never really seen players who aren't playing a divine spellcasting character. I have not really seen any of them incorporate religious beliefs into their character. Certainly not to the extent that clerics do. I'm not saying that nobody I've played with ever has ever had a character with like religious beliefs, but I almost never see it. And that is like really different than real life. So which is always interesting to me when like the world we create in D&D creates situations that like don't really reflect how real human beings interact with like the divine that they perceive.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I think if you, because it can be so present in D&D, I think, right, like where it is very much like you can kind of whisk your warlock off and have them have a conversation with their patron, right? Or like, you know, the patron is like very, very clearly giving them a book or a sword or whatever that they get to use, right? I think like that can create a more like a physicality to like the faith in the game that I think, you know, doesn't necessarily exist in the real world, if you will. I think like going back to what you were saying about having players that choose like characters that don't have that sort of interaction. I'm trying to remember. I don't know. I think I would agree with you. I don't know if I've ever had a player who like didn't choose one of those classes who also really wanted to lean into like, oh, there's this pantheon and I follow this god, or even like really bring it up ever. And I think like some of the games that I've run, like, right, like you'll go to a town and maybe the town will have a temple to some specific god, right? So I think like it might come up there where they'll go to the temple because there's something that they want. But I'm also thinking about like when I run D&D, like the villains, to me the more interesting ones worship some sort of god that wants to bring chaos or some sort of disruption to the world, right? So like I think cultists are sort of like an easy in there. Like there's some sort of doom cults, right, that just wants to like destroy the world, right? So they're trying to bring about bring about some god that was more than happy to do that for them, right? And I think that creates like a very like clear like, oh well, obviously I don't want this world to be destroyed, right? So like this god must be opposed, right? And like the way to oppose them is to take out this cult that, you know, it's there, versus like going to try to kill that god directly.
One of the things that I struggled with this the most when I was younger and running games, but D&D religion has all of the trappings of real world religions, but the fundamentals are way different than any real world religion, or at least most of the major ones. And it's always been a little hard for me to find a place for the gods, like to understand what the faith of a player character looks like in a world where, in the real world here, the word faith contains in it like the sense that you don't know for certain if what you're believing is true. You're putting faith in something it's not a gamble exactly, but like you are making an act of hope and kind of a decision you are making without 100% certainty that it's the right one. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's what is often praised about, is that it's that hope, that act of like hopeful trust, I guess. Mm-hmm. We don't have that kind of faith in a world where the gods like physically exist, and have hit points and
yes, yeah,
and intervene all the time with supernatural evidence of their presence in the setting. Mm-hmm. And again, this might differ from setting to setting or whatever, but switching to the idea of like the gods as like the captains of different teams, rather than kind of concepts that you pledge yourself to, that was hard for me as a really religious like young person. Mm-hmm. Not in the sense that I thought it was like, you know, evil or satanic, but in the sense that it just I didn't know what it would look like to be a faithful servant of whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Grumpsh.
Yeah. Yeah, Glubliek or whatever, the goblin god.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think there's like in the real world, you have like prosperity preachers, like prosperity gospel people who like very much like tie their religion to this prosperousness that comes out of it, right? So it's like, I mean, for them, like I think the real world analog is like, unfortunately for D&D, is probably like this style of religion where it's like, oh, well, I do this thing and I get this result from it, right? If in your D&D game, you stripped away like all the plus to your AC and plus to your attack roll, like bonuses, like I do wonder if the role playing of your PC's beliefs would really really happen as much, right? Yep. If it was just sort of this background, like, oh, like, and oh yeah, you've got this patron, right? Like there's no mechanical advantage or disadvantage, it's just like this thing that's part of your character. And yes, like heck, you might go months without like them interacting with you, right? Or like, you know, yeah, you might, you know, pray and it doesn't feel like anything's happening or whatever, right? Like I think like that would very quickly sort of sideline that part of the character's, you know, character's backstory and character's storyline. Because it's sort of like, I think in TTRPGs, if there isn't a mechanic for it, like it's hard to make it exist and hard to make it like keep happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, if it becomes this rote thing where it's like, oh, you forgot on your long rest you needed to spend 5 minutes praying or whatever, like you know, like if there's no benefit or detriment to not doing that, it's like, well, you're just going to forget about it over the course of a long campaign.
That is interesting. Yeah, because, yeah, so if you're playing a divine spellcaster, yeah, you have that mechanical incentive, whether you talk about it a lot in the game or you just assume that it's happening, which is also a lot of what happens in games, I think. I mean, yeah. I wonder, yeah, if the fact that I wonder if that is kind of tipping to all the other players that this is a part of the setting you don't need to care about or think about because it doesn't really affect you mechanically. Mm. You know, I wonder how it might be different if nobody got any mechanical benefits that were like clearly tied to their religious affiliation. Mm-hmm. Maybe no one would think about religion at all. Mm-hmm. Or maybe everyone would think about religion because it was no longer favoring like a couple of people in the party.
Yeah.
And disregarding everybody else, right?
It's almost like, yeah, if you took away all the mechanical advantages and it was just sort of flavor, I mean, yeah, I think it'd be easy to ignore, right? But like, I mean, I still think you sort of have the, like in D&D, right? Like in these games, right? There's sort of like these alliances, and it's like, it's sort of a way of understanding the world too, right? Like, so if you roll up to a town and the temple there is for a god that you are actively opposed to, it's like, well, okay, like, do we need to kill everybody in this town? You know, like what's going on? Right. Like, you know, so there is that element of it. And I think if you had a kind of a discrete pantheon described and like codified in your universe and everybody sort of understood that, I think it could work really well. What I've often found for me running games is like, it's hard to keep track of all that. So unless I like sit down and like really think about like, okay, this is right, this cultist, you know, these cultists are for whoever, right? And this is in opposition to like this, right? So it's like tangled web of like who's for and against each other, right? Like if you can't keep that in your mind, then like I think it's hard to make that foregrounded in the story unless there is a mechanical advantage that you have to bring out.
What do you make of like in the real world? I would say a big stress point in real world religions is people that like distort the religion for their own purposes, right? Right. I guess everyday people might distort them just to, you know, justify their everyday behavior. But, you know, you think of world leaders or prominent people that, you know, are claiming to represent a religion or to be directly inspired heavily by it, but then who you might look at and think like, well, that's really twisting, like that's really twisting it. Or that's like forgetting big swaths of it. Look how, you see how vague I'm being?
Yeah, you're doing a great job being vague very obvious elephants in the room.
Nobody cancel me. So, yes. Okay. And that is also a tried and true villain, right? Like in the stories we tell. So what does that look like in a world where if you make Grumpsh mad at you, he cuts off your spells and physically manifests his displeasure with you? What does it look like in that world? You know, can you have that kind of a villain, like who is like, well, they are leading this whole city astray with their skewed interpretation of like their god's beliefs? What do you do when the god can say, oh no, actually, you're wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can do that, right? Like, you know, because like if Grumpsh can show up and be like, no, you're actually, you know, very wrong, it's like, well, that sort of takes a lot of the wind out of the sails there. I mean, I think you could do some fun stuff where it's like, well, I don't know, Grumpsh has been killed and supplanted by this other person, right? So it's like all these people who think they're worshiping Grumpsh is like they're not actually anymore, right? Like, so you could do some stuff like that. I think that would be pretty interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right on that. Like the actual real world evil is a lot of the times kind of the hypocrisy of someone saying like, well, of course I follow this or that religious tenet, and then it's like, well, none of your actions support that in any way other than you sort of saying that thing. It's like that is a really hard, that's a huge point of like contention and anger and friction and stuff. Yeah, in the real world, it does make me wonder, like, you know, you could have a lot of fun with that in your game too.
Oh yeah.
Right? Like, yeah, if you rolled up and it's like, oh, like this, yeah, you know, the whole party worships Grumpsh or whatever, and like you show up to a town that says that they do, and it's like nothing matches up at all. It's like, well, what's really going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a ton of fun you could have, you know, like, well, and maybe it's not Grumpsh that this person is serving, and maybe it's something else masquerading as Grumpsh that has that can deliver divine spells and stuff in the same way Grumpsh did, you know, and another god or a powerful being. You know, there's some cool stuff you can do. One thing you see in fantasy settings is they will sometimes leave it a little vague if those magic powers that everyone interprets as gifts of the gods, you know, are those actually divine, or is there another source, you know, for those things that might explain why a huge hypocrite could still be casting spells while going against what you think is the true teachings of Grumpsh. I mean, you could certainly have a lot of fun with it, but it is different than like that classic real world villain of like, you know, the hypocritical like religious leader or something.
Do you, I mean, you've played more Call of Cthulhu, I think, than I have, right? Like how does religion come up in that? Does religion ever come up really in your Call of Cthulhu games, or is it always sort of like there's this evil cult sort of like devoted to an elder god that obviously must be stopped because like we're heroes, you know, like, is it ever like, it must be stopped because we're heroes and we worship some other,
It is pretty common in my games. I have had plenty of people play like a priest or like a priest or a pastor types.
Yeah.
As in other games, it's funny. I mean, when I think outside D&D, it is also the case that in non-D&D games, people don't really tend to inject religion into their characters unless they're playing like a member of the clergy, right? Because in a typical Cthulhu game set in the 20s in like New England, you know, everyone would be religious.
Yeah.
And you might have a priest in your party, but everyone, you might have people in the party that are more religious than the priest. Right. That said, Call of Cthulhu is kind of weird. And I don't lean too much into like religious faith, because the Call of the Cthulhu setting is based on the idea that religion is a lie. And so when you are confronted with like the true reality of the universe, what we call going insane is actually getting a glimpse of how the universe is really set up, and understanding that things like religion are just part of the fake structure and meaning we've created to sort of allow ourselves to not go insane to function. So when playing a game where the PCs are members of like a real world religion, I don't really want to explore somebody having a religious crisis of faith or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we're all adults. I could see that being fun, but like that just doesn't really interest me. For me, I would, that sounds like some great conversations or great books to read, but not something I want to role play exactly. I'd happily role play someone losing their faith in Grumsh, but I don't really want to role play. I'm not that interested in when it comes to real world religion, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it was like Call of Cthulhu is not the right system or way to have that conversation.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it does sort of make me, I mean, that makes me wonder if there are games where those conversations could be like had in a good way.
Yeah,
I don't know. Probably better for your therapist or your pastor to have those conversations, or your rabbi at that point. But yeah, it is interesting. Like, you know, for something that is like, it is fairly, I mean, it's very important to, you know, billions and billions of people. Like, yeah, sort of like getting it right in a game setting. Game setting can be a little tricky, right? But I mean, it also probably just depends on your table too, right? Like we're, you know, so I'm playing in an Eternal Lies. Not Eternal Eyes. Jeez, that was a couple campaigns ago. An Enemy Within campaign that Matt Wilson is running, and like one of our players is accumulating sort of like gods that they are affiliated with, but it's all like the Blood God, and like you know, like it is not the sort of the gods that you necessarily want to be hanging out with. You know, it's not the God of Wisdom; it's the God of Blood. Yeah, and it's like, you know, when those things come up, like it gives you a glimpse into like the kind of the real power sort of behind everything that like we, you know, like it's a Warhammer fantasy setting, right? So it's like you're using this corruption magic, and you're kind of bringing in this corruption into the world. And it is very powerful and very hard to contain and all that, right? So like casting a spell is not something that you just do lightly necessarily, right? Like this is something that could like change the course of history, you know. Like, it's not just like oh, I don't want to get up, so bring my coffee cup closer to me, right? It's like this is a big deal thing, right? And I think like that kind of messing around with those power levels is pretty interesting. And like that's where a lot of, I think you can probably do more compelling stuff with the story. And then like, so in D&D, right, this thought is coming together a little bit. In D&D, right, you have these kind of like these gradations of power, right? So you can see sort of how a level one hero might ascend to a deityhood in some way, right? Whereas in the game that, you know, we're playing in the Warhammer fantasy setting, like there is no path from normal human to deity. Right? Like, you know, like there's a very clean break at some point in there. If there's a discrete number of these gods, like you're not, you know, you're not going to ascend. Don't at me with your Warhammer novels. If you are willing to sort of scale down like the power level, I think between human and deity, like you could probably do a little bit more in there. Like you had mentioned earlier, like the gods have hit points, right? It's like, that doesn't actually make sense. I think like if you're thinking about it, like a real world scenario, right? But like in a game, it sort of makes sense. Cause like, well, of course everything has hit points, but like, I mean, right. Like what if all the hit points of all the deities were infinity, like, or, you know, variations on infinity.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like the leap between you and them is just so vast that you would never be able to do it. So it's like that I think then sets up a little bit more the disparity, disparity between you and them, and then also the faith that you might have to have in them to get that +2 to your AC, you know, and then the boon that they'd have to give to you, the amount that they would have to sort of like humble themselves to even think about you at that point.
That is really interesting. You know, it makes me think of, D&D type pantheons, have a very pagan feel to them, in the sense mm-hmm. of the gods are not these ineffable beings with infinity hit points. Humans can travel across, people can travel across that line between human and divine, and do so mm-hmm. in a lot of pagan mythology, right? Mm-hmm. To me, that's where D&D has always lived. Like, Grumsh is not the, ethereal concept of rage and anger. He is, mm-hmm. he is whatever, an orc that got so powerful that he crossed some sort of line. And now, whether he is, quote, a god or not, he effectively is a god. Mm-hmm. That's where D&D has always lived for me. But, what you describe in the Warhammer thing, that feels more like real world religion to me, mm-hmm. in that, there's this very clear divide between people and, the divine. Mm-hmm. Just interesting. It's neat. I had not really been thinking of Warhammer with its gods. Its gods are even more complicated, because I think lore wise, those gods are all like the incarnations of the people of the settings. Fears and hopes. I'm not a big Warhammer person, at least in like 40K. Gods appear when enough stuff like around their theme happens that it takes like a physical, but it becomes a reality. I don't know if that's the case cool. in fantasy, and I hope I didn't just spoil some sort of big reveal on your maybe, in your campaign. But
we'll find out.
but there's I mention it not to betray my ignorance of Warhammer lore, but like there's just a not having to have your fantasy religions behave exactly like real world ones does give you a lot of space to play with like different ways that mm-hmm. a supernatural reality might interact with the physical world. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty fun. I had one last comment, because we should probably wrap up here. I'm playing there's a Pathfinder video game that has an NPC who is an atheist. They are like
Inside of the Pathfinder.
Setting. And I mean, I think it's there mostly, I guess not shock value. That's a little too strong of a word. It's there to be like a, oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
But it has gotten me thinking a lot. It's like they were a paladin of God, and they just decided they disagreed with the God. And the game doesn't really fully explore what it might mean to be an atheist in a world where the gods have hit points and they like give you they give your friends divine powers. But it is kind of interesting, like what would a refusal to believe or to serve look like in a world where the gods are everywhere, mm-hmm. and everybody is on one of the, what would it mean to like not be on any team?
Oh, that'd be a choice. Oh, that's interesting. I'm gonna be thinking about that for a while. Okay. All right. Well, we should wrap it up here. But that was a good conversation. Yeah, thanks again to Andy for putting together the table. So we are part of the Roll For It Media Podcasting Network. Our sister show, The Splatbook, with John Corey, with Jess and Ben, is great. As Andy mentioned early in the episode, you should go listen to their latest episode. Is really good. Again, they kind of did a rebuttal for us, but I have really been just enjoying listening to that podcast. Kyle is great. And I'm sad that Kyle's not on it, but I feel like Ben and Jess have really injected some kind of interesting conversations and interesting topics and stuff into that podcast too. So go check it out at thesplatbook.com. You can also catch Andy and John on Zombie Strains. They are continuing to make their way through the worst of the worst and the best of the best of the zombie movie genre. I have been told I'm a little bit behind on it. I've been told that they actually found a zombie movie that surprised them with an actress who actually did a fairly good job in her role. So I'm looking forward to catching up on that. Do you have what's coming out next for you guys on that one?
It's more juicy goodness from the mid-30s, I think, is where we're at.
I fear for your DVD collection as it's going to grow throughout this podcast. Okay, cool. Well, that does it for us. I've been Chris Salzman.
I've been Andy Rao.
And remember, if your player's having fun, you're a great GM.